You think about things like mediums, spiritualists, seances, contacting disembodied entities, call them spirits. A lot of chicanery in that world, a lot of flim-flammery that we've read about over the years. And I think that James McLennan, when he set out to explore that area as a young sociologist, he had every intention of exposing it, of catching people pulling tricks and trying to fool the rest of us. Instead, he got hooked. He got hooked on the subject matter. He spent decades studying something called SOHRT, the Society for Research on Rapport and Telekinesis, and ended up finding there's quite a bit to verify these experiences as real physical events that should not be explainable and are hard to figure out, but in fact turn out to have physical reality. In just a moment, we're going to talk to Dr. McLennan about his latest book, The Entity Letters, and it is, as I said earlier in the program, a page turner. We'll be right back. Welcome back. James McLennan, PhD, is a sociology professor and licensed clinical social worker. He's written four books, all of them dealing with different aspects of what might be called deviant science. And by deviant, we don't mean pervs. We mean a difference, deviate from the norm. And I think I don't want to put words into Dr. McLennan's mouth, but it seemed like after reading his book, The Entity Letters, that when he set out, it was to catch people in the act, to prove that they're pulling some kind of tricks, not to verify the existence of what we might call paranormal. Dr. McLennan, welcome to the program. It's great to have you here.
Well, thank you very much, George.
Am I mischaracterizing it, what you set out to do in the beginning? You kind of figured you would catch people pulling dirty tricks, right?
Well, I assumed that would be the case, yes, because everything seemed so illogical. All the evidence suggested that there's something very fraudulent going on, yes.
And when I say the use the word deviant, now deviant science is the title of one of your books. Deviance for a sociologist meaning a subset, a subculture.
Yes, sociologists study, there's forms of behavior which deviate from the norm, so we refer to it as deviance.
You were in Vietnam, and in the beginning of the book, I mean, you don't go into great detail about what you saw there, but I get the feeling that you had some disturbing experiences, like so many young men did, who served over there, and you couldn't quite shake it, so you ended up traveling the world, right?
Yeah, it's pretty strange to run around for a year with a rifle in your hands and shooting at people and giving them a chance to shoot at you, and it's not very psychologically healthy.
You ended up in, is it Nepal or Tibet, where you learn meditation?
Well, yeah, I was looking for some way of kind of coming to terms with things, and so I began practicing meditating in those days in the 1970s, yes.
And you started thinking about learning about meditation and then had thoughts about ESP and whether there's a relationship between the two.
Well, I was in at the University of Maryland in graduate school, and I was in the library, and I was started reading the Journal of Parapsychology, and the parapsychologists in those days felt that they had made a discovery that there's a relationship between altered states of consciousness and extrasensory perception. So I thought I'd do a kind of a little experiment with a meditation group that I was involved in, and to see if there was it's although my methods weren't real sophisticated, it seemed like there was a relationship.
I think you put out an ad in the student newspaper that hooked you up with a couple of students who were interested in the same subject.
Yes, I had a group maybe of four or five people, yes.
And at least one of them was statistically significant, the test you did. Describe it.
Well, yes, it was, but there's what's known as a stacking effect, and so it wasn't really a carefully controlled experiment. But for us individuals, and I was just checking things out, it was kind of surprising.
Well, just explain how it was surprising. I think I remember it was like 15 out of 18 times you tested this person, they got it right.
Yeah, there's one girl who got 15 out of 18 right. What it was is a coin toss after we would meditate together, and then I would toss a coin three times and have them guess what the result would be ahead of time. And So overall, we got statistically significant results, and one girl got 15 out of 18, and that's very improbable. But you know, it's known as a stacking effect. It's possible that could happen by chance, but still, from the vantage point of the individual, it seems very surprising, implausible, in fact.
Did you have a general idea about the legitimacy of parapsychology in those days, or did you just look at it as, I'm a young sociologist, and this is an area that is unstudied from a viewpoint of sociology, and you just want to write about it because nobody else had really covered it?
Well, I was curious, and I was had just come back from Vietnam, and I wanted to study the sociology of war, but my professors that I was studying under weren't that interested in the topic. So I was doing a lot of reading of dry sociological articles, and it seemed pretty boring. So I thought I'd just look into this just because I was curious. I wasn't really much of a believer in it, but meditation seemed like a good way to gain a kind of calmness or peace of mind. And it seemed plausible to me that there could be a relationship between meditating and extrasensory perception. I mean, when you calm the idea is if you calm your mind, then that allows the extrasensory information to come into your mind. So there's kind of a theoretical foundation to the whole idea. And then we did this little experiment, and it seemed to work out. And so I decided I ended up doing my dissertation by studying parapsychologists. I drove all around the country, and I visited various parapsychologists in Europe. And so that was the title of my dissertation, was Deviant Science.
Well, that's really exciting work. I mean, you became a known quantity in that world because you got to meet all the parapsychologists at the time.
It was interesting. They were very enthusiastic about this research method, the Gonsfeld method, where a person would relax and close their senses off, and they felt that they had put together a replicable experiment in those days, and maybe they have. I don't know. It's still under scientific dispute, I would say. The issue hasn't been resolved.
Can you describe sort of the level of legitimate work that was going on in parapsychology at the time? I don't know what the level how it would compare to what's going on now. It was probably more then than there is now. But in general, were there just a few places that were doing this kind of work, or were there several places that were doing incredible?
There were about a dozen research centers. J.B. Ryan, his center was still active, and there was centers out in California and down in Texas, and in Freiburg, Germany, and there was a lot of private foundations were supporting this kind of research, and they were doing a lot of carefully controlled experiments. Now, there's a skeptical community which found fault with what they were doing, but it seemed as if they were making a kind of progress. And so I traveled around and took part in some of the experiments as a subject. And you sit in a chair, you relax, you put like these ping pong ball goggles over your eyes, relax, listen to white noise over earphones, and then you describe the images that pop into your head. And the thought is that this will correspond to some target picture. And then when it's all over, you get a chance to look at the picture, you pick out one, and then they accumulate all these results and see how well you did and how other people have done. And overall, they felt that they had verified the phenomena through statistics. It's a statistical evaluation.
You know, when you put it that way, it reminds me of some of the work that's done in remote viewing. And I'm not sure if you've done much research into that, but in finding mentally projection and finding images that correspond to something that's in your head, that seems like a lot of what remote viewers do.
Yeah, remote viewing became prevalent in those days, and they told me that was a very good method for generating extrasensory perception. So I went out to Oregon and hooked up with a skeptical guy, Ray Hyman, and we did a remote viewing experiment together and didn't get overall, it didn't achieve good results. It didn't achieve statistical significance, so it didn't prove that the phenomenon exists. But privately, I did my own little experiment, and I felt I could feel the things, the image kind of popping into my head. And so I personally was successful, and that was kind of startling for me. I was surprised. I could see why skeptics wouldn't believe in it, because overall we hadn't achieved results. But on a personal level, I couldn't help but think that maybe there's something to it, because it had worked for me.
I know all the way through your book, you harbor these thoughts that you're almost reluctant to admit it. Holy cow, this might be real. But on a professional level, you just won't admit it. I mean, you remain pretty skeptical all the way through, even after experiencing some pretty amazing things that we're going to get into here in a moment.
Yes, I did, and I still am. And I think that when I studied the parapsychologists, I found that virtually all of the ones who were doing the research were believers, but after being in the field for a while, they develop a level of skepticism. They back up from their belief because there's something funny about the phenomena. And I can't help but wonder about you, George, because you've been exposed to this for so many years. I think you've had that feeling too. There's a fishiness involved. I mean, it's as if the phenomena is real, but at the same time, you have to be cautious.
Well, that's for sure. And there's a gamesmanship that I'm not quite sure about the source of it. In 1979, you had you sort of took a turn as the Psychic Research Foundation asked you to look into some disturbances, and I'm using air quotes around that because that's what you describe it, how you describe it in the book, that ends up being something close to poltergeist or a haunting.
Yeah, they sent me out. They suggested that I investigate these haunting cases, and I had never done anything like that before, but I went out and started interviewing the people, and sure enough, they're human, just like you and I. They're regular, normal people, and yet they're seeing ghosts, they're seeing apparitions, and there's poltergeist phenomena going on in their house. And so I didn't just visit once. I started going every week, and I was very curious. What is this? You know, what's going on? It seemed to me there was something about the psychology of the people having to do with the problems in the house or within the family. But at the same time, I myself had an experience where I was on a bed that was shaking and I saw some strange lights. So I could understand. I came to an awareness of why people tend to believe because of their experiences.
Well, I mean, the bed shaking, is that happening because someone believed it, or was it happening independent of that?
Well, I don't know. I was, when it happened, I thought, well, maybe I'm physiologically causing it myself. And I checked my heart rate to see if my heart beating, because my heart started beating very rapidly. It was a strange experience, but the vibration didn't coincide with my heart rate. So I couldn't really explain it that way. And I still had a degree of uncertainty. I mean, it could be that there's some kind of trick involved. There could be a device concealed in the mattress, or, you know, maybe there's, you know, all kinds of psychological factors, a form of psychosis, perhaps a temporary form of psychosis. There's all different explanations. So you never know. You can't be certain exactly what's going on.
That experience, though, causes you to start digging in a little bit deeper to the difference between haunting experiences and poltergeist-type experiences, and you find that there is a distinction, and there is some historical literature that you become familiar with, right?
Oh, yeah, there's a huge amount of literature, and this kind of thing's been going on for centuries and centuries, over thousands of years, I suppose, and I found it wasn't that difficult to find people who had stories to tell, and also a fairly large percentage of people have had experiences in their own house. They feel that their house is haunted. And so I started investigating a number of cases, and I never encountered anything as quite as powerful as that first case, but I found it wasn't as unusual as I thought it would be. It seemed to be a somewhat of a common experience. a lot of people have seen apparitions, and I that was the beginning of a kind of process where I became more and more curious about the spontaneous experiences that people report in this area.
And again, you're not there to study poltergeists. You're there to study people who study poltergeists or who believe it or who see it.
Well, I started studying the people, but then when I started, interviewing people who had the direct experiences. And now the question is there a difference between hauntings and poltergeists? It seemed to me like the things overlapped. Now, there's a tendency, there's a tendency for one case to be more like a haunting and another case to be more like a poltergeist, but the actual phenomena is a great deal of overlap in the area. And in my particular cases, it's difficult to distinguish because most of the people really couldn't figure out whether there's an actual spirit in their house, and the idea that they were causing the phenomena there wasn't any way of verifying that, or there was a high level of uncertainty in that area. So the actual source of the phenomena was very unclear.
1980, you go to this Parapsychology Association conference in Florida, and you meet a guy named W. Edward Cox. And this is, as you describe him in the book, is such an amazing character. And it sort of changes the course of your life after you encounter this guy who is, he's almost shunned by the other people, the other parapsychologists.
Well, he was a quirky kind of fellow. He was a research associate with J.B. Ryan, and he had done field research way back, 1950s, 1960s, and had investigated many cases. And it wasn't something that was very popular in those days. And he was working there in Durham with J.B. Ryan, and I was presenting information about a haunting case, and he wanted to tell me about his haunting case that he was working on. It wasn't really a haunting case, but it was a spiritualist group out of Missouri, and he had begun investigating them in, 1977. He moved out to Rolla, Missouri, to investigate this case, and then he had constructed. J.B. Ryan had suggested that they create sealed boxes which nothing could enter or exit without breaking the seal, and then they wanted to see if the spirits could cause things to exit or enter the box. So they had created these boxes, and sure enough, they got all this phenomena. So he had wanted to document it or verify it beyond the shadow of a doubt. So he had created what he referred to as a mini lab. It was a sealed box, a kind of an inverted aquarium, and it had a micro switch in the floor so that if an object lifted up off the floor of the box, it would trigger the film camera, and then that way the camera could document whatever occurred inside the box. So he had generated a few hours of film of psychokinetic phenomena, and he had presented it at this conference that I was present at. And it was just so, so very, very bizarre. It looked like stop-action photography to me and to everyone else at the conference. It looked absurd. But objects were moving around in the box. They were coming out through the front of the glass of the face of the box. They were levitating in front of the box and inside the box. And some of the phenomena were very, very bizarre. Paper would burst into flames. There was a balloon which inflated and deflated. But most of the effects looked like it was done through fraud. It looked just totally absurd. And so he invited me to come out to Missouri to look at this, and that's how I got involved with the Society for Research and Rapport and Telekinesis.
Well, it seems like there was a great reluctance on your part because, like, as you mentioned, everyone else at this conference thought it seemed ridiculous, and you agreed with that. But you went anyway, and it really changed the course of your life. We're talking with Dr. James McLennan about the entity letters, the fifth dimension, Age of Aquarius. Take us into the break, and there's a reason we're playing this song. It plays a kind of a funny role in this story, and we'll hear that in just a little bit. We're talking with Dr. James McLennan about his book called The Entity Letters. So he gets invited to go to this other state to help investigate a series of really strange events. He is inclined to believe that it's a bunch of hooey, but goes anyway, and he hooks up with something called Surratt, and experiences, instead of a fake activity, experiences tables moving, levitating, poltergeist phenomena, earthquake effects, and then these letters, a series of letters that became the title of this book, The Entity Letters. We're going to get into how it was documented and how he came to believe there was something to it right after this on Coast to Coast AM. James McLennan, so you agree to go along with this guy, Cox, who you're not quite sure if he's the real deal or legit or not, but you go along to take a look at what he called his mini lab, which is sort of like an aquarium, right?
Yes, it's an inverted aquarium, and it's strapped down with metal bands onto this wooden board. And in the floor are micro switches, which activate a film camera. If anything moves in the box, and it turns on a camera.
And he's got sort of a series of special features that he's installed, and tricks, and hairs put on locks, and all kinds of things. He can supposedly tell if anybody tampers with this thing in the house where all this strange stuff is going on.
Well, that was the problem. When I first arrived in 1981, the people were friendly. Tom Richards and his wife, Elaine, were living in the house, and they invited me. I was staying at the house myself. And then that first afternoon, Cox arrived, and he invited me to come look at his mini lab in the basement. And he is a very quirky, had a very quirky personality, and he was totally over-focused on doing these experiments. And I, of course, didn't. I thought I was just going to do a quick visit and figure out who was being tricked. But he spent a lot of time to set up this mini lab. He put in secret hairs in there, and he had a special lock that, and a special seal that he placed over the lock, and he stamped it with this notary public stamp. And the whole process involved something which a real Rube Goldberg invention. It had dust on the seals were covered with dust, and it even had a special thread that he put through the casp of the lock, and he sealed it with a match so it would burn in a particular angle when it was completed. It would be very difficult to duplicate all these things. And then the next morning, the phenomena had occurred. There was a message inside the mini lab, and it said, "Hi, Jim." That was a message to me. And it was disturbing to me, because I knew, I could tell I had been roped into this phenomena. And I thought to myself, well, thank God I didn't take pictures, because certainly my memory could be fallacious, and no one, I don't want to testify to anyone that I had actually been involved with this type of thing. But that was the beginning of this process, what ended up to be a very long-term investigation.
Well, what did they tell you in the beginning of the, describe the depth and breadth of the kind of activity that's going on at this place?
Well, this is a group which began meeting in 1961, and it was founded by Dr. John G. Neihardt. He was a very famous poet. He was a poet laureate of the Plains States, and he was the author of the book Black Elk Speaks. He had befriended the Lakota Sioux Native American Black Elk and had written his biography in this book, and it became a bestseller in the 1960s. So as he grew older, he had the idea of trying to replicate spiritualist phenomena, and so he gathered together a group of college students at the University of Missouri, and in 1961 they tried what's known as table tipping. They would put their hands on a table and dim the lights, and then they would have the perception that the table moved around. And after a few months, they started hearing raps coming out of the floor, and the table not only moved around, but could come up in the air and could levitate. And so then they started taking photographs of it. All this occurring in the 1970s, not too long after they began doing these kinds of experiments. And this created an incredible reaction from the officials at the University of Missouri. And some of the students were expelled, some lost their visas, some lost their scholarships. So they very quickly found that they had to be more secretive about this, you know, the phenomena. So Neihardt's graduate student was John Thomas Richards, Tom Richards. So he was, you know, wanted to seek employment. He was away from the group for about a year, but then when he came back, they reorganized the group so that in the later 1970s, I guess 1975, the group was reorganized, and they started getting more levitations, and they were more careful about exposure to publicity. They were careful about who they invited to participate, and just with a select few that were doing these experiments. Well, Neihardt died in 1973, and Tom Richards continued these experiments, and so did the other Surratts. The other group members also had the capacity to do these kind of things. So in 1981, when I began my investigation, they had been doing this for 20 years. And I was a sociologist, so I figured, well, I'll interview these people. I went to people's houses, I talked with them, and they all had scrapbooks and showed me pictures after pictures of levitating tables, which they had taken. And they explained to me that this might not actually prove to outsiders the phenomenon was authentic, but they were kind of like mementos of events that they had witnessed themselves, levitating tables. And so that
now, as you get to know them, I mean, you get to know them, you get to like them, but you can't help but believe that they are somehow faking it, or they're causing it unconsciously or subconsciously to levitate, and other things are happening, not maybe overtly dishonestly, but are somehow responsible for it, as opposed to something paranormal.
Well, the phenomena has certain characteristics. You put your hands on the table, and it has a kind of vibration to it. It's a very, very rapid vibration. So that seems very unusual. And the assumption is that people are pushing the table with their hands. So if everyone takes their hands off the table, it stops moving. So you would assume that people are moving the table with their fingers. But you can look very closely, and it didn't look like that when you look at it. Then there's also the rapping sound. And Cox had done a lot of research to try to figure out what's causing these raps. He had a stethoscope, and he could find the exact point where the raps were coming from. And they could come from wooden floors, concrete floors, even from the bare ground. They came from other people's houses, even in public places and restaurants. So that was perhaps the most bizarre phenomena, or unexplained, a very recurring thing, the most common phenomena. The levitations were somewhat rare. And then from the very beginning, it seemed to me that there's a kind of hiding quality. The phenomena had a kind of robustness, but it seemed to me like I could always devise some kind of explanation, possibility for how it might occur. Like there might be wires attached to the table, or threads somehow attached to the table, and in no case was that ruled out. So there's a high level of uncertainty associated with this thing.
The group eventually works out a system of communication where the raps, it's a language that you develop, a system where you can exchange messages back and forth with whatever this thing is, right?
Yes, they used what's kind of spiritualist code. One rap is A, two raps is B, three raps is C, like that. And then also the raps could answer questions. One rap is yes, two rap is no, three rap means maybe. So you could ask the thing a question, and then it could answer. And it creates a kind of a laborious process. Like if you say hi, then they would start rapping out, rap, 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 you know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, O, H. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, O, H, I, hi. So you can communicate with them. You say hi to them, they'll say hi back.
And I'm reading this as this goes along, and this entity, intelligence, I guess there's more than one, but it almost has a sense of humor, some of the stuff that goes on.
Very, very quirky sense of humor. Like, for example, I'm with Ed Cox, and he wants to demonstrate to me that the raps are paranormal. So he said, well, ask him to rap out on the wall over there. So they'll rap out something like "on the wall over there." They'll comply, but in a joking manner, and it has a very, very intense quirkiness and a hiding quality.
And you're looking. I mean, you look under the floorboards. You're looking under walls. I mean, you're looking for how the rapping could be manufactured by somebody in the group. And even though you like these people, you have to be suspicious and you have to look for prosaic explanations. But after a while, you don't find them.
No. And the looking itself causes the phenomena to decline. The more intensely you look, the less it occurs. So you're not rewarded for scrutinizing things closely. But yeah, I looked at Tom Ridger's shoes. I looked everywhere in the floorboards. And Cox had also done a lot of careful investigation. But he had come to the opinion that the levitation couldn't really be explored scientifically. That's why he had confined his research to his mini lab in a sealed box. But the whole thing was disturbing to me because I could see how this is going to ruin my career as a sociologist. And I didn't see how I would be able to publish my results in a sociological journal. And that turned out to be a valid concern. I wasn't able to.
You know, the idea of the intensity of the study affecting the phenomena itself is a familiar theme to me because of what happened at Skinwalker Ranch. I don't know if you're familiar with any of that, but a place of activity, high paranormal and unexplained activity in northeastern Utah, when a scientific team comes in and sets up shop and starts pursuing it, eventually the whatever it is, it gets tired of being pursued and it kind of goes away, goes underground. And then once the study ended, it came back.
Yes, that book of yours is a very good book, the Skinwalker Ranch phenomena. And the parapsychologists were encountering similar things. They refer to it as a decline effect. That is, the more carefully controlled experiment you conduct, the less probability of success.
But you had some pretty spectacular things that went on. Not only, I mean, the levitations in person that you saw, but then the title of your book, I mean, what eventually happens with the entity letters, you ask it to do some pretty amazing things, and it does.
Well, they were interacting with me on a very personal level, and it seemed, and I had done haunting cases research before, and it seemed to me that the best way of working with the phenomena, that it seemed likely that the phenomena was a manifestation or associated with people's consciousness, and that if the phenomena were allowed to express itself, then the people could express themselves, or if the people were allowed to be more creative or express themselves, that would help channel things in a more positive direction or a more psychologically healthy direction. So I decided to encourage the phenomena to write. And it had done a lot of writing under controlled environments within the mini lab and even before the camera. So I left a postcard, and it sent me and put up my own address and put a stamp on it, and it sent me a postcard. And so I could, then I would typically stay with the Ridgers for a week and then go back home to my home, which in those days was in Maryland. So I started sending letters with self-addressed envelopes. And they would write letters to me, and they became like pen pals. I was writing letters and communicating with these spirits. And other Surratt members picked up on this, and they also started sending letters. So it became a kind of part of the process, the entity letters, we called it. The entities were writing these letters and communicating with people.
And you got letters sent from faraway destinations just to prove that it could be done at a spur of the moment.
They had all very, very strange postmarks. Truth or Consequences, Arizona, or Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and a lot of times they would have foreign stamps, and there were typically a strange writing on the outside of the envelope, a picture of a clock without hands. They wanted us to believe that they were outside of space and time. And the theme of this is that there's life after death, and that when you die, you will be outside of space and time. This is some kind of a dimensionless feature, and that's what death is like.
We'll come back to that. I mentioned we played a little clip of Age of Aquarius, that song, and it kind of made me smile to read about why it played a role in your book. Can you tell that part of the story?
Well, the spirits like to sing. They like to make music, and they would make the rapping, and the table would rap, and it would rap out tunes to songs. So one of the songs that they liked was the Age of Aquarius, and the Serrats created a, it could have been the spirits, I'm not sure. They created a words to the song. It is the dawning of the Age of Aquariums, Age of Aquariums. And they were suggesting this is like a new age in which people would communicate with spirits and we'll learn about life after death. And this is some wonderful new era which is going to be coming about. And so that was one of the ways people would amuse themselves. The phenomena wouldn't work regularly. It was the Serrats believe that the key is rapport, that the harmony within the group helps facilitate the phenomena. So singing together seems to facilitate the action of the phenomena. So people would sing that song and other songs. 1, 2, 4, 6, 8, come on table, levitate. You know, that would be something. You say that again and again, and then the table jumps around and comes up.
Communicate with what you think are different entities, different spirits who have personalities, right? And names.
Well, yes, they would sign their letters. And so a particularly frequent author or writer was an entity called, who called himself John King. And he was a 1600s buccaneer who had served with Sir Henry Morgan, theoretically. But he also has a history in spiritualist lore. He came through many, many mediums of the past. So the phenomena was tied into old-time spiritualism. A lot of the old-time spirits were now manifesting themselves here in the 1980s, 1990s, and the year 2000 here in this Rolla, Missouri.
And Black Elk is one of them. You know what? Can you tell briefly the audience who Black Elk is?
Well, Black Elk was a Native American who John G. Neihardt had kind of hung out with, and he had learned about Lakota Sioux shamanism and then wrote his book Black Elk Speaks, which became a bestseller. So he knew Black Elk he was very familiar with Black Elk. They were very good friends. So when they first started getting the phenomena in 1961, that was the spirit that came through. And Black Elk Neihardt spent a lot of time investigating and interviewing this spirit, and he was convinced that Black Elk was authentic. And Black Elk was very much a healer. That was his main seeming function. Each other spirits seem to have different types of function. But, of course, the question, to my mind, are these spirits authentically the people who they're supposed to be? And I conducted all kinds of different experiments, none of which really worked out. They didn't demonstrate to my satisfaction that they had extrasensory ability, and nor could they provide information which would prove that they knew something that the people in the group didn't know. So that was always an open question as to whether this is are the spirits real or not. That question certainly has not been answered very effectively.
We're talking with James McLennan, Dr. James McLennan, about his book, The Entity Letters. It's a heck of a read. This is a long-term study of what we would call paranormal or spirits. And when we come back, we'll get into what some of these entity letters said and how they were acquired.